Technology will come to order. Just a few things before we get to Mike from the Department of Administrative Services. One, I met with Dallas, and he is a most effective administrator. And Luann came and we were set up, and thank you, Luann, for the downtake and the upset again. We're going to do a couple of things. One, in front of you, Dallas and I sat together and put together a schedule that will take us out to February 17th. That will give you some notion of what's on the agenda. And I would like to get to the Department of Administrative Service. And, Mike, we were expecting Don, and how's Don doing?
Well, I'll tell you. Now, for the record, Mike Fries, Deputy State Chief Information Officer, and I'm standing in for Don Fleming today, who regrets that he can't be here with you. I'm sure he'd much rather be here than where he is. He performed a remarkable and no doubt thrilling acrobatic stunt during the ice storm and ended up breaking a couple of ribs, so he's at home recuperating. He's doing well. We've been talking with him, and he'll be back as soon as he can. So with that, I'd like to talk with you about our organization, Information Resources Management Division, and probably more importantly, some enterprise initiatives and enterprise issues that we're dealing with. So let's start with an overview of IRMD. IRMD is really the largest organization physically within the Department of Administrative Services. We have about 300 employees engaged in a variety of functions. Many of those are in the publishing and distribution operation, which tends to be somewhat labor-intensive. That's the printing and mailing operation. But there are a variety of other functions, which I'll describe as we get a little further in. We have offices and programs located in six buildings in three cities, Portland, Salem, and Burns, Oregon, where we run the State Data Archiving Center. The head of the division, as I mentioned, is Don Fleming, the State Chief Information Officer. And Don joined us almost a year and a half ago now. And Don has an extensive background in the private sector, working for firms such as Allied Signal and General Electric. And he's brought sort of a fresh perspective to information technology. He also has extensive experience in consolidation initiatives, which is pertinent to what some of the issues we're looking at now. The mission of the organization is to provide leadership within state government for effective development, management, and enhancement of digital technologies, particularly information technology, and to provide core technology and communication services and infrastructure and support to Oregon state agencies. And we'll talk a little bit about what that is as we get further into the programs. We have a variety of statutory authorities that deal with everything from telecommunications to printing law, and we also operate under some executive orders that deal with things in the realm of e-government and geospatial information systems. The organization is broken down really into three areas, and this will help sort of reduce the complexity and really give you an idea of where we're focused. We have operations, which are ongoing technology services. Think of those as utilities or infrastructure services. Governance and oversight, and that's a role that should be very important to this committee. That's where we take a look at information technology initiatives that are conducted either on a statewide basis, enterprise, or very important information technology initiatives within state agencies. And we are actively engaged in those, and I'll talk in more detail about what that process looks like to make sure that they're meeting the objectives that were set out for them, that they're on budget, and that the projects are under control. And then we have enterprise programs, which are really change initiatives. And what this is focused on is producing more cost-effective services within Oregon state government and or delivering new capabilities. And we'll talk about how we're doing that. So let's start with operations. These are the stable, what we call stable infrastructure services. And those periodically would go back and take a look at and see if we need to do some re-engineering, because technology, as you know, continues to evolve, and the technical strategy through which you deliver a service can change over time. Voice telecommunications is a really good example of that. What's happening with voice over time is it will be repositioned as what we call an application that gets delivered over a network, just like a variety of other services do, just like data is delivered over a network, and now we're seeing teleconferencing and everything coming through basically the same pipe through a phenomenon known as convergence. We currently provide telephone service to 52,000 state employees, and we do that for a very competitive rate. Today, $34 a handset, which is less than we could buy it for on the street. And next biennium, it's actually slightly less than that. And we negotiate competitive contracts for telecommunication services, including both voice and data, which are used by state agencies. We do that also in collaboration with other entities like the Oregon University System and the state lottery, and everybody leverages that volume to drive contract prices down. The publishing and distribution operation, as I mentioned, that's state printing and mail services. It also includes the interagency shuttle service. And one of the things we've done in that operation, about a little less than 10 years ago, we started a pretty massive consolidation initiative there. Prior to that time, each agency had its own mail room, and some agencies had pretty elaborate mailing operations. And that's kind of important, because what happens is that the degree to which you're able to automate mail and process it in advance drives down your postage cost. The cost of producing a document could be 3, 4, 5 cents, and we may spend 37 cents to get it to its end destination. By doing some pre-sorting and some work with that material, we can get that those costs way down. We can knock 10 to 15 cents off the cost of the postage. So we started a consolidation project, and we brought the various components that agencies had together, and by aggregating that mail volume, we were able to save many millions of dollars in postage a year. So that's an important aspect of that program. The other thing that's happening in publishing and distribution, it continues to evolve over time. What we're finding is people use, they print less of specific documents. There are more documents now that get printed, but a lot more stuff is going on to the web. And so there's a logical relationship there. As we see a decline in physical printed material, we're going to see an increase in electronic transactions, and that ties back into the e-government program, which is something I'll talk about a little bit later. The Systems Development and Consulting Group really focuses in a couple of areas. It supports our centralized legacy applications, the kinds of applications that everybody uses. Examples would be the statewide financial management application, the human resource systems, personnel and payroll database. So those things that are common to every state agency, this group supports. They also provide technical consultation and programming services, or coordination of programming services, for agencies, typically smaller agencies, that may have a project that occurs once every 2 to 3 years, or maybe once every 5 years, and they aren't going to have the capacity to either analyze or manage a systems development project within their organization. We provide that consultation and coordination service. Governance and oversight is a piece, I think, that might be of critical interest to this group, because we're your...
Yes. Pardon me, isn't it? Yes, Representative Connell, you have a question?
I do. With regards to the programming systems analysis, project management, and database administration for state agencies, is that a mandatory requirement that state agencies utilize your services, or can they go outside if they so choose to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it is not a mandatory requirement, and applications are an interesting thing. There are, for applications that are, there's a high degree of business commonality or commonality in business requirements, those things, it makes a lot of sense to build, coordinate, and manage centrally. There's another class of applications that I would call line of business applications that are really tied to very specific business requirements of state agencies. And in larger state agencies, because that's really important that there's a strong connection between the application development and support and the business function, they tend to resource that themselves, either through internal staff or when they have a big project. Clearly, they're not going to staff up just for that big project. It'll be a mix of internal staff and possibly outsourcing to get that done.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, on to governance and oversight. The governance and oversight group includes enterprise planning and policy, and we provide support to information technology governance bodies, research, analysis, staff support. One of the things that's I think has been really positive over the last few years, and it's in fact I think increasing in terms of the speed with which we're moving things forward and the, our ability to get things done, is our bodies like the CIO Council, which you have probably heard about. That's a group of either chief information officers and or the head IT individual within organizations, and they have been meeting for some time now. We provide support to that group. And that's the body through which we want to start driving enterprise architecture and standards. In fact, that work has already begun. Those are the kinds of things that will allow us.
Excuse me, Mike. The acronym, what's the name of the group again?
It's the Chief Information Officer Council, CIO Council, we call it.
Thank you. Excuse me.
You're welcome. That group is really the folks that sit in that group stand sort of with one leg in the technology world and the other one in the business world, and they're the person in their agency that's responsible for the information technology strategy to support their agency's business strategy. Well, there are some things that we find that are common and that we can leverage to produce economies of scale and to be a lot more efficient. That's the group through which we're beginning to identify some of those opportunities, and in fact, that group identified data center consolidation as an opportunity we should be pursuing back in 2002, and it's something we're pursuing today. It's a group that we would want to use, and we are using, for development and promulgation of statewide policy. Again, architecture and standards. Architecture is the framework within which, and the rule set within which, we agree to build information technology so that it is more interoperable, so that we can begin to bring data together in ways that are meaningful to decision makers, both at the agency level and in the legislature and elsewhere in the executive branch. And if you think about it, it's kind of like you have to have a blueprint for a house, and you have to have then a solid foundation, and then you can start building things on top of that. That's some of the work that we're doing now. Also does IT investment management, strategic planning. We have been are involved currently in updating the state's strategic information technology plan. And typically the way you would develop an information technology plan on the enterprise basis, you would start with a state business plan, and your information technology plan would help you enable that enterprise business plan. Well, the state really doesn't have something you could call an enterprise business plan. So what we did was work with the state agency directors who are participating in the CNIC project and their CIOs and collected some requirements and we're in the project.
Could you define CNIC for us?
Yes, I'm saying.
I'm familiar with that term.
Yes, previous, Mr. Chair, CNIC stands for Computing and Networking Infrastructure Consolidation, Data Center and Network Consolidation.
Okay, thank you.
Previous committee chairs have opted to have a jar, which we would contribute to if we use too many acronyms. I'm hopeful that I'll get through this hearing without having to pay too dearly for that. At any rate, that group, the CNIC agency heads, have participated with us in beginning to collect requirements that may lead to some common infrastructure strategies. So we're trying to get to have a more meaningful and actionable information technology strategy than you would have seen in the past. It's very difficult to implement a strategy. So once you have a strategy, you then have to have some enabling plans that help you implement that strategy, and that's the work we're doing through this group right now. We also do coordination of information technology master contracts. A master contract would be something that we go out and procure once, and then you can execute individual projects and task orders against, rather than having to go through the procurement process for every single instance. Project review, oversight, and reporting. And we have historically, you know, we take a hard look at the quality assurance program, and it was put in place for a couple of reasons. One is to ensure or to steer projects towards success through early intervention and making sure that all the structure and stuff was in place for IT projects. The other thing, though, it's supposed to do is identify when something may be going off the rails, okay, before we have a major project disaster. We think we need to strengthen that program pretty substantially, and that's something that Don is committed to doing, and we plan to restructure it in the coming biennium. One of the things we've done is that we don't want to treat every project equally. Some projects are relatively small, the risk is relatively minor, they're not necessarily technologically complex, and we don't have to pay a great deal of attention to those unless we see some warning flags coming up. The ones we really want to focus on are those things where there's a lot of money involved, potential high risk or high public exposure, and or what I would call a strategic project, one that has strategic impact. And that could be a project that has a higher dollar value, or it could be a relatively small and non-complex project, but it may set a de facto standard or put us on a technological path for the foreseeable future. Those things we want to think about. So if we implement something and it's going to tie us to a specific technology approach for 15 years, we really ought to pay a lot of attention to that. So we're repositioning both the filtering mechanism for which ones we focus on and our approach to quality assurance, and Don will be talking with you about that in more detail later on.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Crowell.
Mike, for most of your program managers, what kind of a signature authority do they have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it depends on the program that they're running. And, for example, telecommunications, we have huge amounts of dollars that flow through that program, and so that the person that's responsible for that would have a higher level of signature authority than the individual running, for instance, the Systems Development and Consulting Group. So the program manager who's overseeing network services may have a signature authority in the hundreds of thousands of dollars range, and you would see recurring expenses in those ranges coming through there. Systems development and consulting, it could be under $50,000.
Okay.
So it's very much dependent on the business.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Certainly, yes.
Then what would be the... how did you come up with $500,000 as being the oversight? Any project exceeding $500,000 is an oversight, as opposed to, $250,000 or $200,000 or $100,000,
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it's not a purely arbitrary figure. What we took a look at was the projects that, historically had been things we needed to be most interested in and pay the most attention to. And if you draw a line at $500,000, you end up with a manageable number of projects, okay, that we wouldn't have to have, hundreds of people running around focusing on all the time.
Okay.
So what we had intended to do is, as we move forward with this process, we'll monitor that and see how that works, if $500,000 is the right level. The other, without getting too complex on this, it's not just dollar volume that determines the complexity or risk in a project. There are a number of other factors. One of them would be, what is the business complexity? I mean, does the IT project have substantial potential impact on the business processes of the agency, and or is it technically complex? Typically, state government is usually nowhere near what we would call the bleeding edge of technology, but we probably want to be a little closer to the leading edge than we are today. So that can introduce some technical risk as well, and then, of course, interfacing with existing systems.
Thank you.
If I could back up for a minute, Mike. The CINIC project, your acronym, I hope I'm using it correctly, the CIO, that's the group charged with implementing CINIC?
Mr. Chair, no, the CIO Council is actually a larger group that involves a variety. It involves CIOs from a large cross-section of agencies. CINIC, the Computing and Networking Infrastructure Consolidation Project, is constrained to 12 agencies. And I'm going to go into quite a bit more detail on CINIC and the governance process over CINIC as we get into
it. We're going to come to that?
Yes, we will.
I'll wait.
Okay. So, moving on to enterprise programs. Enterprise programs we create a bucket for that, and it really, this is the place to think of as the incubator for either new services or for services that we want to take and we want to substantially change how those are delivered. And there's really two components to this. One is what we call attacking the base of operations, and the concept here is that there may be ways to reduce the cost and or improve the efficiency of how we deliver a current service today, either through a new technology strategy and or through consolidation. CINIC is a good example of that. And the other one is establishing new capabilities. A good example of that is electronic government and cybersecurity, which the state is now having to build some much more robust capability to deal with cybersecurity issues. Enterprise programs, this is, again, an incubator. Enterprise programs will move into operations as they become more stable, as they mature. You have a well-defined, stable product and service and a financing strategy. Typically, the strategy for incubator-type operations is that they would be funded through assessment or some kind of mechanism for a period of time until they get up and running, and then they may move into a fee-for-service basis. That, in fact, is what our strategy is for e-government. That they're accepted and valued and understood by the customer base and are competitive with alternative sources. And we make sourcing strategy decisions based on whether we can do it most effectively and cost-effectively or whether we can buy it. Not every technology is a candidate for one of these, and that's something that we spent quite a bit of time making sure we understood really well. Over anyone who's been around any large organization for a long period of time knows that it goes through periods where we tend to centralize things due to cost pressures, and sometimes we end up centralizing things that maybe don't make a lot of sense to centralize, and then those get redistributed over time, so you have this effect of centralization and decentralization. What we're really looking for here are things that truly make sense to do at the enterprise level. So there's a high degree of commonality amongst business needs, and there are economies of scale that can be leveraged to produce savings and also to enforce some uniformity in the way that people use those systems. The strategic planning process that I touched on earlier is the process we want to use to identify what those enterprise strategies are and what those incubator programs are. The page 12 is a chart.
Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Hello. Yes.
Is working.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you.
Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, I'm particularly interested in the GIS, Geographic Information Systems, and I'd like to get a little better feel for what DAS's role is in this. I mean, it's, you know, it's a great tool, but it can also be problematic in the fact that federal land management agencies have their own, ODF's got theirs, counties have theirs, and a lot of times the data is not portable, the data standards aren't consistent across ownerships, et cetera. What are we doing?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, that's a great question. There is a state GIS coordinator, and what has happened over time is that individual in that office and function is responsible for coordinating between varying levels of government, includes state and local government, federal government, and to get at the very issues you described, because one of the things we have is common data standards to make the data useful. Geospatial data is basically information that we would take in a variety of different layers, we would call it. And some of them may have to do with, for instance, the locations of utilities, landscape data, demographic population information, economic data, and that gets overlaid on a spatial layer so you can see relationships between different things in different locations. If everybody's not using the same standards, then you kind of roll it up and it becomes gray paint and it's not particularly useful for making decisions. So that's what the work of that group has been, and they've made quite a bit of progress. One of the things that we've done, though, in the last year is taking a look at the task ahead of them, and it's pretty monumental. I mean, there's this coordination exercise, and then there's all these data standards that have to be cranked out and the data that has to be produced. And the amount of time it would take to get that done, the program is really insufficient to get that done in enough time to be useful. So we are going to be proposing a strategy to accelerate that, focused on the most important data layers and then building around that. And it'll be a strategy that both state and local government would be involved in and the federal government would be involved in. We're currently trying to produce a business case that would show what that would look like and would also deal with issues like what might be funding strategies to make that happen. And a lot of that, the funding strategies really are tied to investments that are already planned and being made, but coordinating them and making sure that they produce results in as quick a fashion as possible.
Follow up,
certainly.
Mike, the state GIS coordinator, that is a position?
Representative Burley, that's correct. And we have a very small staff that administers some central infrastructure. There are three other staff people in that group.
And that person works in this department in DAS?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Excuse me, yes, Representative Burley, we have February 8th set aside, and we'll look at GIS in some detail.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And I'll cover it a little more extensively, too, as we get further into this.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so we have some enterprise programs, the CNIC, or Computing and Networking Infrastructure Project, e-government, GIS utility, this is what I just briefly outlined here, information security, and business continuity planning. And this is not just the technical focus. We're currently looking, it's really a business issue, so we have business representatives that are participating in this process, and I'll talk in a little more detail about that as we go in. Let's look at the CNIC project and think about CNIC as sort of laying the foundation for doing a bunch of other things, for looking at ways that we might be able to go after some enterprise applications and or data integration. First thing we're doing is pouring the concrete and laying the foundation. And the objective here really is to save money but not at the expense of service. We want to be able to maintain or improve service levels, and there are some good reasons why we think we can do that with this project. This has been...
Representative Ruth?
Yes, before I even asked, thank you. I'm wondering, where do we expect the largest amount of savings to come from in this consolidation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, a substantial portion of it comes from human resource savings, so we can do the same work with fewer people. Some of it comes from better price performance ratios on equipment, and as I'll describe a little further on, we're highly fragmented and subscale in our operations today, so consolidating allows us to get more bang for the buck. And the bulk of the savings in terms of where it comes, what specific agencies it comes from the three largest agencies, the Department of Human Services, Department of Transportation, and DAS, and those three really run the main data centers in the state.
Yes.
Okay. Now, this has been it's not a new topic. I think that the state government has been talking about data center consolidation ever since there were data centers, and this is the first time we've gotten anywhere near this far along, and we're well underway in this project, and it's going forward with an expected completion date of the end of the 2005-2007 biennium, so it'll take place throughout the coming biennium. There are 12 agencies participating in the project, and we did that for a couple of reasons. We wanted to keep the complexity down to a level that was manageable, so we didn't want to go after every single thing we call a data center in the state. And we also wanted to have a big enough group that it could have substantial impact. So the 12 agencies that are participating in this have been involved actively from the beginning of the project in both the sponsorship and leadership role. And one of the things we did early on was to ask these agency heads of the agencies who are participating to become a governing board for both this project and for the resulting service, because we want to make sure that we capture the business requirements of the agencies and that the resulting service is sustainable over time. And we think the best way to do that is to make sure there's an active role for those agencies in the ongoing operation of this thing. So the governance model is really like a board of directors, and you have a list of the agencies that are participating in the project here on page 15. We were very cognizant, too, as we were building that process, that this is a model that could be applied to other enterprise initiatives. And as I mentioned before, we want to identify enterprise initiatives through that planning process in this same model, which has been very successful in helping us move the Scenic Project to where it is, could be applied to other enterprise initiatives. So let's talk for a minute about what we look like today. We have 32 things we call centers, computing centers. There really are only three real data centers, and these are data centers that folks who work in large-scale data centers in the private sector would recognize as a data center. There are three of those, DAS, ODOT, and DHS, and we run mainframe computers and a variety of other different classes of computers and central data centers. And there are 29 things that people would probably classify more as server farms. They may be multiple servers tied together to support the applications for state agencies. The environment's very, very fragmented, and we knew that it was fragmented when we started the project, but the project, the way it's structured, it starts with an analysis phase. So we do an inventory of what we've got, both the staff and the infrastructure investment, and what it costs to operate that. And we compare that to industry benchmarks for both just average and best in class, and what we find is that our infrastructure is really, really fragmented. For example, the three largest centers combined equate to about 60% of what by industry standards and benchmarks would be a medium-sized data center. And the 12 largest, all of them that are participating in this, get to just over 75%. So data centers are the kinds of things that tend to become much more efficient and cost-effective as you consolidate them further and further. And there is a point of diminishing returns. Yes?
Pardon me, Representative Wood?
I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if the 32 centers of computing in the current computing and network environment, what are the total FTE right now, or human resources in the current environment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I can't answer the question for the 32 because we haven't done that analysis, but there are currently 100 in scope, what we call in scope for this project, there are 140 some odd FTE that are in scope for the current Scenic project.
Thank you.
Welcome. Again, because these things tend to get more efficient the more you scale them up, and typically you only ever see that diminish in data centers the size of, for instance, American Express's data center. We're never going to get to that size. So the good news for us is that we have a lot of potential here for savings through economies of scale, and that will probably not ever end within Oregon State government. That also, by the way, drove the decision for us to move to a single data center rather than two data centers, because there were the compelling economic reasons for doing this, and the economics of a single data center are far better than two data centers. The other point was, and the reason you would build two data centers is for some redundancy. In fact, nobody ever really does that very successfully. What tends to happen is that the reserve capacity is looked at as excess capacity and waste, and there's a tendency to fill that up, and pretty soon you're right back where you started again. So the current environment really can't be sustained, and we have to change it. That's why we think, though, the scale issue, we think we can produce the same or better service, much better service at less cost. One of the things we discovered was that, as we were doing the economic analysis, is that there are other equally compelling reasons related to cybersecurity, related to disaster recovery and business continuity planning, and the scale at which we're operating today, those things become almost unaffordable luxuries, and that's one of the advantages that will be afforded through consolidation. Again, we're going to maintain or improve service levels while achieving savings, be able to operate around the clock, have managed and measurable service levels, and we'll be able to have tools and processes that will allow us to be a lot more efficient and effective, and reduce some of the critical risk issues that I talked about already. The business case has been produced for this, and we've gone on now to make the project more aggressive at the governor's direction. We're beginning the work of involving the technical staff today in detailed planning, and they're working with our contractor to produce the detailed plan for consolidation, which will include in what order agencies go, what the technology looks like when we get there, those kinds of things. The real value, though, of the Scenic Project is what I described before. If you think about it, this is sort of the concrete or the foundation for future initiatives. It's what it enables us to do in the future. So there are things we can go after, additional standardization, where we can leverage more economies of scale, have more interoperability of both data and applications, additional consolidation initiatives, system and data integration. We look at, for instance, electronic messaging, email, and the state has multiple email systems today, and there's really not a very good reason for that, except that it's an artifact of the fact that every agency has kind of done its own thing over the time. We could produce substantial savings and create some efficiencies and, frankly, better support for the businesses out there if we had a standard system, and that's one of the opportunities we'd look at going after.
Sure. Can I ask a quick question?
Representative Worth, excuse me.
I'm wondering if you are planning any investments to achieve the improved service and you're consolidating, but how are we looking at any kind of training provisions to make these the folks who are now in the consolidated centers better able to serve?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, that's absolutely true. And in fact, one of the symptoms of being subscale is that people tend to not have enough money for things like training, and certification in both the current software standards and in current management practices. The part of that is what we call one-time transition costs. So if you look at the way the project structures on a financial basis, it's pretty simple. It costs us, let's say, this amount to do this today. It'll cost us this amount when we do it in the future with sufficient budget built in for ongoing training and equipment replacement. And then it costs us some amount to get from here to there. And the savings stream then will return that, or will repay that one-time transition cost, and we'll achieve return on investment at some point in the future, currently projected at the end after the next biennium. But yes, that's a very good point. Training is built into that. And we will have to train folks because they'll be using new, more modern equipment and different tools and practices.
Yeah.
I mentioned before that the business case is completed, and we took a fairly conservative and intentionally conservative approach. We didn't want to overpromise. And the business case seems to indicate there's substantial savings opportunity. The governing board presented the business case to the governor, and the governor directed the project team and the governing board to be more aggressive and to produce a more aggressive savings plan. And really, there's only two ways you can do that in a project. One is to accelerate the pace of the project so that you hit your return on investment point more quickly. And the other one is to increase the scope of the project, so you put more things within scope that you can leverage economies of scale for, and we're taking both of those approaches. So we've just completed an exercise working with the 12 participating agency CIOs to increase the scope. Prior to the increase in scope, the stuff that was in scope really went up to what we'd call the remote router, where the agency plugs into our wide area network. We've now increased the scope up to what we call the wall plate, which means where your PC plugs into the network, and that's pretty substantial. That now includes all the security devices within the local area network, the local area network itself. So it really becomes more of a utility.
When you say the governor asked you to pick up the pace, has he had a presentation similar to this, or was when he told you to let's go, how was that done, letter?
Mr. Chair, what the governing board met with the governor, and this, I think, speaks, by the way, to the success of that collaborative governance process. I was there to present the findings of the business case, but the governing board made the recommendation to the governor to proceed with the project. And these are the 12 agencies that are giving up their data centers through this consolidation project. And what the governor said was that this is good. It's a good start. And the business case certainly is compelling enough for us to go forward. But, you know, we have a dire budget crisis here, and we need to do everything we can to be as aggressive as possible and produce the most savings. And so he was pretty clear and explicit that we need to go back and take a look at the project and see what we could do to make it more aggressive. And for the reasons I described earlier, we went through that scope reset process, and that's where we are now.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Murray.
Mike, so the increased scope then, I understand, going from the wide area network portal to the wall plate, but it doesn't include any more than the 12 agencies originally part of CNIC.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, that's true. I think that when we get through this project and this thing becomes stable, the state data center or whatever it ends up being called, we will then look at the other agencies who were not participants in the initial project, because they will have then a mature infrastructure that they can move into. Page 21 includes a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I see on page 23, wait. I should have looked at before I asked you this last question, but I'm wondering if the $20 to $25 million in the one-time transition costs, what percentage of that do you expect to go to training, because it's also split between consultation and the equipment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, a relatively small percentage of that would go to training. A lot of it is actually the transition cost. The equipment acquisition is only a few million dollars, so the bulk of it is actually the detailed planning, the moving, making sure that we don't break anything while we're doing it.
Okay.
I can get you a specific, if you're interested, I can get you a specific number.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Page 21 gives you a general project timeline, and there are four basic stages to this project, excluding the scope reset stage, which we called stage zero. Normally you don't see a stage zero in a project, but for the reasons I described earlier, we inserted another one. Architecture defines where we're going, what the target organization looks like, and it's at this point we have to blend really two bodies of knowledge to produce a successful project: our current agency technical staff's knowledge about what the agency business requirements are and their technical configurations, and our contractors' knowledge about how you do a data center consolidation and introduce new technologies and processes while you're doing that.
So we should be able to, in June, the architecture should be in place. And that's a building, a raised floor, and a place to put the boxes, or are the boxes there?
Mr. Chair, let me clarify how we use the term architecture, and we get kind of tied up around the term architecture. In this case, architecture refers to the technology architecture. So this is sort of the framework, the standards on which we're going to build the technology environment inside the data center. The facilities project, the construction of the actual facility, is a sort of a separate project that happens in parallel with this.
So when we talk about architecture and technology, what you're going to give us, or what we're going to see, mm-hmm. is a plan for purchasing boxes, style of boxes, that sort of thing.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I see that's by the end of the second quarter, so that would be June 1st?
Mr. Chair, actually, that's gets into what we call detailed design. Architecture describes the target environment and where we're going. The detailed design is the detailed consolidation plan, including the order in which agencies are consolidated and what the template looks like for producing the plan. At the end of the first quarter, we will have an updated business case. So we'll know then what the financial target is that's a result of this scope reset.
What I'm looking for is something that, and I'm concrete and sequential. I'm looking for something that I can go and look at it and say, aha, this is done. When's that going to happen?
Mr. Chair, you'll have, there is actually several deliverables. The first, let me start from the back end of this one where we lift the first data center. And that first data center will be either Department of Human Services, Department of Transportation, or Department of Administrative Services. That's currently scheduled to occur in the latter part of this year. And that the big three data centers will be consolidated in the current project schedule by June or July of 2006. So that's the point when we've got the bulk of the work done in this thing. Backing up from that, the facility will be ready to occupy a month or so before the first data center is lifted, and so we'll have a chance to do some extensive testing and practice lifts. Prior to that, what we have to do is develop a agency-specific lift plan. And that answers questions like, are we going to take the applications and the databases that reside in this infrastructure and move them to a different infrastructure? Or are we actually going to pick up the machine and physically relocate that into the data center? That will occur over the summer and into the fall as we begin the first lift. Backing up from that, there's a higher level piece that gets at what is the strategy? Are we going to, for instance, take an agency at a time, or with the big three agencies, will we take their mainframe operations and consolidate those first and then go after other ones? That's going to happen in the second quarter of the year. And the stage that we're in right now is talking about what are the technical standards and what does the organization look like that occupies the new data center. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Brady.
A couple things, Mike. First, when you refer to quarter one, quarter two here, you're talking about the state's fiscal year quarters, not calendar year.
Representative Burley, we're talking about calendar year.
Okay.
In this case.
Yeah. And I think the chair was asking questions kind of along the lines I was looking at, but I'm a little curious where. Is it in the business case that we're going to see the measurable performance outcomes, the things that not only this committee but everybody can look at, and whether or not we declare victory when this is done? We really saved, we did this, we did that, here's the measurable performance standards. Where's that all laid out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things that people we know will be skeptical about this project, and we have to be able to show that the money was saved at the end of the day. The way that the project is structured, we have a business case, and think of the business case really sets a financial target, and there's some margin, a comfortable margin of error in what that financial target is. As we get through detailed planning, we'll narrow that down tighter and tighter, and we'll know exactly what it is that we're going after. The team that will work out of the project management office, one component of that is to make sure that we capture the business case. So we'll have people who are financial analysts and who are responsible, for instance, for liquidating the existing assets, for returning the existing space back to usable office space or for some other purpose, and we're going to capture that as we go through the project so that we'll be able to show at the end of the day that exactly what was spent, what the costs were before, what the costs were afterwards. And our intent, and from the very beginning of the project, has been to track that very, very closely.
Mike, if I were to talk to a captain of industry or perhaps a lieutenant, and I were building a coherent system in industry, what kind of a timeline would I look at? Do you know, how does this compare with the private sector?
Mr. Chair, we think that this is an extremely aggressive project for Oregon state government, but it's not what we would call a slow project for the private sector. Some private sector organizations have undertaken data center consolidations, and one of the critical path items is, do you have a facility that's capable of housing the data center? Where private sector organizations already have multiple such facilities, they can move a lot faster than we can because they don't have the facility critical path item. In the case of the state of Oregon, we first researched whether any of our existing facilities were adequate, and they really aren't. They were not built to be data centers. you know, one of them is two of them are in the revenue building, actually three, and some of them have windows. You don't see that kind of thing in a data center. There's inadequate power and inadequate other kinds of infrastructure. We also looked at other options like buying an existing facility and retrofitting, and when we compared the time frame for that kind of a project to building one, there's really not much difference, and there are a number of advantages to the state building its own center. So the project schedule is very similar to what you would see for a similarly complex consolidation in the private sector. And we've intended to move this project very quickly for a couple of reasons. One is it has to produce savings in a relevant time frame, so the sooner we can get through it, the quicker we can get to return on investment. And the other thing about it is because we're picking up infrastructure and moving it, it has a high potential for disruption if it's not managed very quickly or very effectively and aggressively. So it's one of those things where going as fast as prudently possible is the safest course of action, and those are some of the values that have driven the project. I believe I talked about the existing data centers. They really aren't adequate. The new data center facility is being constructed out on Airport Road between the lottery and the print plant. In fact, the walls were tilted up just yesterday. I've not been out there to take a look at it since that happened, but it's probably looking more like a data center than it was last week.
Where's it located again, Mike? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. may I ask?
Maintaining formal committee rules. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where is the data center located again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, it's on Airport Road between the lottery and the print plant. Are you familiar with where the motor pool facility is?
Yes.
You head down State Street and take a right, and you'll see the construction off on the left.
Okay. Thank you.
Mike, we should forewarn you that we're planning to come look at that facility about the middle of February.
I heard a rumor to that effect. Yes. Good. It'll be something to look at then.
When would be the best time?
Mr. Chair, actually, that'd be a good time because it's now a building, or so I'm told. I hear that the walls have been tipped up. I haven't gone out and looked at it yet. But you'll get an idea of what the size of the facility is and also how we're dealing with both physical and other kinds of security issues there. So that time frame should work.
If I may, just this field trip is on your schedule for February 17th, and what the plan is, we're working with the agencies, is to take you to look at the three big ones, the existing data centers, so you get an idea of where they're housed, what they look like, what's in there, and then finish up, go to the new one so you can see. It'll give you a much better handle, I think, on the issues around security and a lot of the things that can be addressed through a central data center.
Okay.
Thank you, Dallas.
So we've talked about some of the thinking that went into the decision to build, where it's located, and why we get some savings out of this through economies of scale. And I've also talked about the one-time transition costs. We have to spend money to get to a point where we're saving money. And the one-time transition costs include things like consultation, the detailed implementation planning, some equipment, and staff training, and remember that we're going to end up with fewer people producing the work than we have today, and so there are costs associated with dealing with that, redeployment and possibly retraining for other kinds of jobs. Facility costs, approximately $20 million. The financing for both of these, by the way, is through certificates of participation, although facilities are financed over a longer period of time. It's more equivalent to a mortgage or something like that, where it pays back over 25 to 30 year time. So the facilities costs really become an operational cost for the data center. They lease the facility. The one-time transition cost to pick up the compute load and move it into the new data center will be repaid through the savings between the current environment and what the consolidated environment looks like. As I mentioned before, the governing board consists of the 12 participating agencies, and the post-implementation, the governing board will oversee this operation. I don't know if you're familiar with the term shared services or not, but it's a concept that we're introducing here because we think that it helps make sure that the thing that we're producing is sustainable over time, that it remains tied to supporting the business missions of the agencies it's supposed to support. The difference between a purely centralized and a shared services operation, there are several, but one of them is that a shared services operation is accountable to the agencies, to the businesses who are dependent on it to service and for service, and that's why we're keeping that governing board concept in place as it goes operational. Technical oversight for the project is provided by the agency CIOs. They make up the steering committee for the scenic project. And again, agency technical staff are now involved working with the contractor to produce the detailed plan, and they'll be involved in actually executing the consolidation. Our vehicle for informing the legislature of this project and seeking approval for moving forward with the project has been through the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. Okay.
Mike, there's some frustration on the other side of this house with the pace. Can you give me some notion why the frustration level is so high?
Mr. Chair, with the pace of this project in particular, I really can't tell you without knowing what the specific criticisms are about the pace. I do know that the initial project plan called for us to be working well through the architecture phase and into detailed design at this point. The reason that we're behind on that is, remember, we were directed by the governor to go back and take a look at making the project more aggressive. That required us to insert an additional stage called Stage Zero or Scope Reset. And so we wanted to not have to go through the whole top-down business case again, but what we did working with the Scenic Steering Committee and Governing Board was develop a process to be able to put more things in scope and then put it back into the project structure. One of the most dangerous things you can do with a project of this size and complexity is to constantly change the structure of the project, because that's the thing that ensures that you'll capture the savings you say you're going to capture, and that we won't break things as we pick them up and move them. So if you have some specific examples, I'd be happy to respond to those.
Nope, I think you answered the question very well.
Thank you.
Chair, I have a question.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, you mentioned that that COPs will be used. So are you looking at funding training with the COPs this biennium? Or when is the training planned to be done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, the training will have to occur, obviously, before the folks are occupying the new data center. Okay. It would probably happen early in the next biennium, because you want to train people as close to the time when they'll actually use that training as possible.
So, Mr. Chair, so we're not talking about this biennium getting them trained?
No, we're not going to spend a lot of effort on training for the operational piece of the data center. There's a training component that's sort of inherently involved in the project, in that, mm-hmm. you know, we talk about how we're going to do this stuff, and that's part of what we're doing in these architecture work groups.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. On to e-government.
Mr. Yeah. Chairman, I guess I hate to leave this scenic thing alone here. I guess I'm still, and maybe I'm missing something, so please correct me if I've missed this, but I'm still trying to figure out, are we going to get performance measures, or are we going to get some criteria that we can use to track this process? And the reason I keep going back to this is, and I hate to bring this old thing up, but the DMV debacle that mm-hmm. occurred years ago, and you know, I've worked on computers a little bit in the past too, and you always have a tendency to try and cut some corners, you end up with something that doesn't have the horsepower you need or one thing or another. So, you know, I guess I'd like Mike for you to kind of give us a little oversight on, you know, what did you learn from the DMV debacle, and what are we doing to prevent that from happening again? And how much of this work is being done by private contractors such that if there are such errors, we have some means of recourse to go back to instead of just having to go to the general fund to make up for our mistakes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, a couple of things. One of the things I think that the state learned from the DMV situation many years ago is that we need to have a really good project management discipline in place and a quality assurance oversight process in place. And one of the things, we remember the first part of this project was really run pretty leanly, because what we were doing was a form of statistical analysis to determine whether there was a business case. What we're doing from this point forward is very complex. It's not like what DMV was doing, which was actually an application project, but it's still very, very complex, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong if they're not well planned for. Now, having said that, it's been done many, many times, so it's not necessarily risky, but you have to make sure the discipline's in place. We've substantially enhanced the state's project management office to manage this project for the second phase. We've brought in project managers both from within DAS and also from other agencies. And in fact, we're currently in the process of recruiting a senior project manager to run the next phase of the project. Our contractor, the roles and responsibilities of both the state staff and the contractor are clearly articulated in the state of work, and it's very clear, you know, we can hold them accountable to the deliverables in that contract. And then we will have a third-party independent quality assurance contractor who will oversee the project as it goes forward. And that's, you can think of that as two aspects. One is to guarantee that we stay on track with the project plan and that we're delivering what we say we're going to deliver, and also as an early warning system if something is starting to get off track. That's part of the function of QA, is to push back and say, well, you know, you're not doing what you said you were going to do in the project plan here, and this is the risk that it introduces, or I see this happening over here, and this is the risk that you need to mitigate. The other piece, and I realize I didn't respond to this in your question earlier, one of the things we can't do today is that, you know, everybody assumes that when they operate their own service that the service level is good, but what we don't have is any objective data that would say that. I mean, nobody really has well-managed service level agreements in place, and they don't produce metrics that would tell you that they're managing their service to an appropriate level. This data center will have that built into its operating processes. So there would be service level agreements that specify specifically what the service level is for each agency, and we will measure those. And in fact, that's how the performance of the data center will be judged. Cost, does it meet the service level requirements of the agencies?
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to e-government. We have a fairly modest objective here. We're going to transform state government, actually from a citizen's perspective. And if you think about what we're trying to do here, really is pretty simple, and it's not much different, conceptually pretty simple, and it's not much different from what industry has done with e-commerce and so on. But we want to make it possible for a citizen or a business to navigate state government without having to understand how we're organized. And that's really sort of the value principle here, is that you can get a service or access to information without having to understand what department is responsible for providing that service or information. We started with, in the realm of content, web pages that are published out there for informational purposes, and that's one component of the program. Another component of the program is supporting business online, so being able to conduct business with state government, transactions with government, in a more seamless way, and to be able to do that on your turf at the time of your choosing, instead of having to come into a state office during the hours of operation. The components of our e-government platform today, and the e-government program to date has really been about putting an infrastructure in place that's enterprise scalable and capable of supporting some of the initiatives that were already underway. Follow-on initiatives will be exploiting that platform to do some things like being able to tie agency business processes together and to be able to do more things online. Oregon.gov is the new state website, and it's the portal, the central place that you can come to get to anything on the web in state government. We're using what's called content management software. One of the problems that we had was we have hundreds of thousands of web pages that were created by hand, usually, and that's sort of the evolution of how the web came into being. And at some point, maybe it's a 10 or 15,000, it becomes fundamentally unmanageable by human beings. You need software to help you manage something of that magnitude. That's what the content management system does. And, for example, when we rolled out the Brand Oregon initiative, it made it much easier to roll that out across multiple web pages and websites, having a content management solution, because you make one change and then you can roll it out, and that would have been virtually impossible without having a content management solution.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Cole.
Mike, since you brought it up, I wanted to ask about the Brand Oregon, and not to digress necessarily, Mr. Chair, but what I'm curious about is that, first of all, are all agencies that are on the Oregon.gov web portal utilizing all of the same materials as far as Brand Oregon is concerned, same color schemes, same print fonts, same general stuff, so that everything looks like Brand Oregon is supposed to look?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, that in fact is one of the benefits of having a content management approach, because the way the system works is it separates the content, the information, from what we call presentation. Okay, so we use a template-based approach, and there are multiple templates because we have different kinds of documents and different kinds of needs, but they have the same sort of thematic consistency throughout all the templates. And so the way that the system works is an agency will go in and enter content literally into a form. They type in a form and they choose what template they want to use, and then they publish the form through workflow, and what comes out then is thematically consistent with the brand.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Then, do we have any agencies at this point that are not utilizing the Brand Oregon look and feel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, we have not converted every agency into the content management system yet. That conversion will continue and will be completed, I believe, in 2005. There are also a few legacy systems sitting out there that have not been converted yet, but you'll see those get cleaned up over time.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, certainly.
Are any of our major agencies, such as Human Services, Transportation, Public Safety, or State Police, not utilizing the Brand Oregon look?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crum, I want to make sure we separate the Brand Oregon look from the content management solution. The major state agencies, I believe, have mostly been converted. There are still some that need to be, and if you're interested in that information, we can get that to you. There, for those few remaining sites out there that would be, for instance, a database instead of just a web page that somebody's querying against, I can't answer that specific question. There may still be a few of those out there that don't look like Brand Oregon, but I really don't know the answer. We'd have to get back to you on it.
I'll hold in for any more questions for now.
Thank you. Yes, for Julie Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering about the semi-independent regulatory agencies or boards, and how are they kind of all moving towards or evolving towards this content management, and especially like the licensing and all that. I mean, how much standardization are we getting with those folks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, actually there's a couple of different things that come into play there. One is the content management solution, and a number of the small boards and agencies that have participated in this and actually see it as beneficial, because they see it as tremendously beneficial, because most of them don't know how to create a web page. You know, in some cases there were folks that didn't have any kind of web presence, and because you don't have to be technical to use this system, they can just enter content into it, and it takes care of the process for them. Another thing that comes into play here, and I really can't speak in detail about this, is something that the Department of Consumer and Business Services is leading, is the regulatory streamlining initiative, one component of which I know is a desire to make licensing processes look much more similar between varying government bodies. And we have worked with them on that. They really own the business process. We're talking with them about how we can support them in moving forward with that.
Okay, thanks.
The e-commerce is another critical component of this platform, and that's what allows people to buy things online from the state. And in the intranet, and this is something that is not externally visible, it's not available to the general public, this is something that we can use within state government to drive content down to individuals based on, for example, their role, what kind of a job they hold, what kinds of things they might be interested in, what department do you work for. So it's customizable at various layers based on that individual's identity, and that concept is scalable up to providing services to specific citizens. So that we're able to customize it very easily based on the role of the individual.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Cole.
Mike, is this the, earlier you referred to the archive facility over in Burns. Is this how we're connected to the archive system over in Burns, is through the intranet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, no, we're connected through a network. And we are we can secure that connection. In fact, that's one of the issues that, that needs to be dealt with in our reconfiguration of the network. Currently, the data that goes from here to Burns, it's encrypted because of the software that's being used to send it from here to Burns.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a proprietary format. We want to be able to encrypt that further to make the data more secure. The data in Burns, it's completely secure, and when it in the data centers that it comes from, it's presumably secured as well. But yeah. It's not an intranet. Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up.
Yes, follow up. Certainly.
You made a key comment there when you said presumably. Mm-hmm. It is secured, and that it's not on the intranet, so that means it's going over basically open wires. And although what kind of encryption then are we using? Is it like AES, or is it 128-bit, 256-bit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, currently what's happening is that the data, there can be actually multiple layers of encryption. An example would be if we're backing up an Oracle database, that the data is encrypted in that database, that encryption layer remains intact.
Okay,
furthermore, we're using a proprietary software which we're upgrading today that has, you would have to have a access to that software to be able to decode the data. The third layer, and this is what we're putting in place now, is a virtual private network, basically, which would encrypt that stuff while it's in transit between Salem and Burns. The reason I made the comment that it's presumably encrypted, or that it's presumably protected at the data centers, is we do presume that. We check for that, but no one can ever guarantee you that they are 100% secure, because security vulnerabilities continue to evolve, and it's something we have to really be vigilant about.
Thank you.
With the CINIC, we saw a project timeline. Do you have a project timeline for e-government to include a coherent web package and a coherent information storage package? Is there a timeline when these projects will be finished?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific timeline for those two issues, but we would be happy to get back to you with more information.
I'd really like to see those. Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
I have some. You can see what the eGov top level page looks like, and this is an example of the branding that I was talking about. Again, it's imposed by the templates on the system. That should be a place you can start and get to virtually any state government information or any online transaction capability the state government has. And then page 29 has some statistics. I won't go through those in detail, but you can see that we're conducting a substantial amount of business, both in terms of providing information and transactions, business transactions through the e-government platform.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Crummell.
Thank you. I was noticing on the copy web page that you have here at the top, and where it says what's inside Oregon.gov on the right hand side, and it's an A to Z agency list. Two questions with regards to that. Number one, is that an agency and employee list? Actually, three questions. Secondly, is it up to date as far as up to whoever actually works for the state today is on that list, and who doesn't work for the state today is not on that list? And is that list being utilized, or is it being updated and so on, utilizing, for example, LDAP directories, and so the system is basically automated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, a couple of things. There's the list that you see on the right is generated by the system, and it's a hierarchy of state agencies. The agencies themselves are responsible for maintaining the content of their individual agencies. And the statistics on the next page, I believe we've got a piece in there that talks about, or maybe we don't, there's substantial churn rate that we're seeing. This is one of the things that we're measuring. We're seeing that content change a lot, and that's a good sign, because what we found before is there was a lot of stuff with cobwebs on it out there that was outdated and that people were still accessing. Okay, so that's dependent on the agency's updating. We do have an LDAP, which stands for Light Directory Access Protocol. It's a database of objects, and in this case, the objects would be people. Okay, The LDAP actually is key, a key infrastructure component of the e-government platform, and the LDAP contains information about every state employee, and in fact that's what we use to do customized delivery of the intranet. So I work at Department of Administrative Services. I'm in the information technology arena. I'm in executive management. You could deliver or channel things to me through my personal portal based on my job profile. The same concept can be extended to manage security of systems, and in fact that's one of the components of a cybersecurity program. So we intend to leverage this platform as we move forward to do those kinds of things. The employee directory, a searchable employee directory, is automatically maintained, and that's generated from a couple of sources. One source is the current personnel and payroll database, and that stays very current. That every time a transaction occurs where an employee's job status changes, that gets sent through that database, and that updates the online directory on a batch process basis nightly. And the other source of data is what we call an X500 directory. That's a central directory. It's similar to LDAP, the central directory that really coalesces all the data from the email systems that the state has. And again, that's refreshed through a nightly batch process, so that data is current. If you go to search for an employee's phone number or their email address on the web, it's as current as the data that's provided from those other systems.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, and again, we have some some stats. I'm not going to go through the statistics here, but you get a sense for the volume of activity that's occurring on this platform. And to date, as I mentioned earlier, really what we've done is put in infrastructure. We've laid the foundation with this platform. It provides us the opportunity to do a lot of things in the future. Again, the future e-government services, now that we have the platform in place, what do we build on it? We see that being determined through the strategic planning process that I talked about earlier, and we'll do that in collaboration with the state CIO council. Okay. Moving on to geographic information systems, the goal is to ensure availability and easy access to high-quality geographic information for a number of purposes, public policy, dialogue issues, planning, also emergency response. It has applications in that realm. So it's a collection of data about various different attributes, and it has a geospatial overlay that allows you to see the relationships between different things happening based on location. Give you an example, especially in the emergency management arena, we have had situations where lives and property were literally saved because of having good geospatial information. For example, maintaining or controlling a fire, it's really helpful to know where the access roads are and whether there may be gates on those access roads, whether they're locked, whether there are people living in homes on those roads. That kind of information has actually allowed fire management crews to prevent loss of life and limb and property. We've also had the converse of that where because someone didn't know that there was a high-tension wire, for example, crossing an area, they flew a helicopter into that high-tension wire and people died as a result of that accident. That's information that could have been made available to those people through good geospatial information or geographic information system. I mentioned before the cat herding exercise we have to do kind of on the collaboration between state and local government and federal government, and we have a council that does that called the Oregon Geographic Information Council, comprised of, again, state and local government and federal government representatives and the state GIS manager and coordinator runs those meetings. What we've done to date, I talked a little bit about this earlier, continue to manage implementation of the statewide GIS data standards. And what that means really is people get together and agree on what the measurement's going to be, what the standard is, and how we're going to go forward and implement that. And it's not just within state government. Again, it's multiple layers of government. I talked about where GIS data sharing has literally saved lives, but it has many other uses, too. It again, could be used for planning in terms of growth development, where roads might be put. There are a variety of applications for it, for economic development planning. We have a plan to accelerate the pace with which we move forward, too, because to make this thing really useful, we've got to get beyond establishing the data standards, and we've got to create a utility that everybody can use. And so that's the plan that we're working on today and what we're trying to produce a business case for. We would provide some training to folks so they know how to use the technology and put in place a geospatial utility that provides access not just to people in government who need access to it, but to anybody. It could be something that could be tremendously beneficial to any citizen who wants to look up information, for instance, about water access rights and those kinds of things, or to a business wanting to locate or move within Oregon could use that kind of a utility to do research. Okay. Let's move on to information security.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Two questions. One, you talked about the Oregon Geographic Information Council, and I was curious whether or not OSU's Institute of Natural Resources is part of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I'm not sure whether they are or not. I'll check into that and get back to you.
The reason I asked was I spoke with their executive director, and she was talking about some ideas, portals to allow public access to these GIS state systems.
Yes.
Which sounded like a pretty good idea to me. And then the other question I have is, what sort of reaction are you getting from local governments, counties, cities, in trying to standardize things and share them and make this a more, you know, transparent system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, this is an area where people have enlightened self-interest. So even though it's difficult and complex to manage different arms of government and also different levels of government, they clearly see the benefit in coming to some standards because nobody unilaterally can produce all the data sets that they need. Each one's dependent on some other authoritative source. And the state has responsibility for some of those. The federal government, Bureau of Land Management, and others has responsibility for some of them. And a lot of the information comes from the county level. So they see the benefit in it, and generally we get really extraordinary cooperation and collaboration there.
Good. Thank you. Uniform was probably a better choice.
Mike, on this line, you talked about herding cats and different agencies with different authority. Do you have some sort of a notion when we'll have a standardization?
Mr. Chair, we actually have several standards that have been already developed, and that's the GIS utility concept is intended to accelerate that standard development so it can occur over a period of a few years rather than taking the rest of our natural lives to get them all done. So that's the intent of the acceleration strategy. We have already developed those several critical standards.
Thanks, Bill.
Yep. Okay, moving on to information security. Let me frame this by saying that information security is one of those things that has become increasingly and rapidly important over time, so that you have really a nonlinear curve in terms of the risk exposure and the threats in the realm of cybersecurity. And coupled with that, we're increasingly dependent, and we're going to be increasingly dependent on information technology as we go forward. So things that used to be annoyances, things like spam, for example, and hackers and those kinds of things that were more annoyances are now becoming very real risks and threats that have to be managed aggressively. And we've recognized this for some time, and we have put in place a state information, chief information security officer and office. And we did, for the first time, a comprehensive vulnerability assessment and threat assessment with the 12 agencies participating in CNIC, and have produced a plan to mitigate the risks that we identified in that process. This is nothing unusual. It's the same kind of thing everybody who's connected to a network has to go through today, any organization. And so that's really where we're going with information technology security. We've done the assessment process. We're producing a detailed plan. We divided the planning into two areas, really. One was sort of what I would call triage. Let's get after the most critical issues as quickly as we possibly can. And one of the strategies is let's put up a fence, for example, around our computing and networking assets. And let's go after those systems that may be the most vulnerable and make sure that they're well protected. And then there's longer-term strategies that get at how do we build security into the planning process when we're developing new applications and new systems and so on. How do we make sure that that's dealt with? So there are really two components to that strategy. It's not possible for people to do it unilaterally because, again, we're increasingly interconnected and interdependent, and security is one of those areas where you're really only as strong as your weakest link. And if we have if Agency A has a trusted relationship and interconnection with Agency B, and Agency B has a weakness or vulnerability, that can be exploited to get to Agency A. Those are the kinds of things that you, and the complexities you have to deal with in the realm of information security. And the other piece of it that's really important is the human aspect, because no matter how strong the technical infrastructure and practices are, you're always dependent on people to follow, one, to be aware of the risks and to follow the rules, and that's an important component of this, is education, ongoing technical training, and the ability to measure what we're doing. If you look at page 38, this illustrates the concept I was talking about before, and you see, again, a nonlinear progression in the level of threats. This is it looks more like a tidal wave, and it really is, we see that increasing over time, and there's two ways to think about that in terms of cybersecurity. One is that it's very, very easy for someone who's non-technical to launch a cybersecurity attack because there are all kinds of handy websites out there from which you can download tools that allow you to do that. And then there's a more complex or difficult phenomenon to deal with, and those are people who actually know what they're doing. And those folks oftentimes get into systems and you don't even know that they're there. So we need to be able to protect against that whole range of threats. So the threats that we're talking about are worms and viruses. Those are, propagating at a remarkable rate on the Internet. The social engineering piece, this is the concept here is that if I can get you, it's sort of the con man scheme, if I can get you to respond to or click on or go to a website to do something and I pretend I'm somebody I'm not, I might be able to have you divulge information you shouldn't divulge and or download some clever little tool that will allow me to infiltrate your system. So there's an educational component there. You know, we don't want people clicking on a site that says, hey, you just won $1 million and go off and download something that could be harmful to the systems. There are some vulnerabilities in existing systems, networks, and applications. Some of them are just artifacts of the fact that many of these systems were built in the days before we had such a thing as the Internet and cybersecurity vulnerabilities. And others are a function of scale. It's what I talked about before, that we have not put as much resource on this as we arguably should have just because we haven't had the capacity to do it. And then security breaches where somebody does successfully penetrate our defenses and gets in, and we need to be able to deal with that. So the immediate plan calls for, again, putting up the fence, establish and improve a network perimeter. And today we really don't have something you would define as a perimeter that's defensible. That we want to do very quickly. And when we get done with the Scenic project, we'll have a very defensible perimeter that all the participating agencies would be within. Reduce the exposure by building on the action plans that were already implemented late in this biennium. The initiatives primarily target the Scenic agencies, and there's a reason, too, why we timed the security project to link up with the Scenic project at this point, because one of the most powerful vehicles we have to mitigate security risks is the Scenic project. The degree to which we can engineer in good, well-designed networks and good security practices as we're implementing Scenic will help us resolve some of these security issues. So the timing is really very good for this, and Scenic will be one of the vehicles we'll use. The other thing that became apparent to us, we actually moved the network consolidation component of Scenic forward in the project because that securing the network and establishing a defensible perimeter is one of the best things you can do to mitigate security risk. The continuous improvement, again, would be based on evaluation of risk reduction. There's no such thing as being 100% secure as long as we have something plugged into the network, but we want to make sure that we've appropriately identified what the risks are and appropriately mitigated, and that's ultimately a risk and business call. It's not an IT, just an IT issue. Okay? Let's move on to business continuity planning. This is another area, and you'll hear me talk about complexity and interconnectedness, and it's interesting. Business continuity planning, we did quite a bit of that around the year 2000 rollover, and people did. What we discovered then was that our business processes are to some degree interconnected. So if I have a business process that's priority one, it must come back up, and I have to minimize the disruption. But if I'm dependent on you for a process, if that thing's dependent on one of your processes and that's number 36 on your list, I'm probably going to have a problem bringing my business process back up. It, from that point, you go forward a few years, and we're now even more interconnected and interdependent. And it's therefore really impossible for me in a silo unilaterally to produce a comprehensive business continuity plan. We need to have one at the enterprise level as well that captures those key state business processes, understands what the interdependencies are, and makes sure that we resolve those conflicts in priority so that we can bring up the key state business processes. And that's what this program is about. The plan would result, basically, it would enable organizations to restart the critical business functions and continue essential services. That doesn't necessarily mean bringing up the business processes as it exists today or the system, but to have a continuity plan. And typically there's a couple of components to that. It's how do we bring it back up in the interim, and or how do we then restore the original business process and get it back in place. As I mentioned, it can't be just a collection of agency business plans. There has to be an enterprise component, and that's what this program goes after. And who benefits, of course, is anybody who is reliant on or makes use of state services. Interestingly, there are some federal funding implications, too, here, both here and in cybersecurity, not just cybersecurity, but actually information technology security in general. And agencies that are dependent on federal funding, the feds have recognized that this is really important, and funding may depend on the degree to which people are successful in implementing both security, information technology security, and business continuity plans. We put together an interagency work group to work on this issue. We've got a project manager who's leading the project, and this is a work group not of information technology people. It's folks who represent the business side of the equation. The critical process selection criteria has been developed, and the integration of business continuity with emergency management and disaster recovery, that's taken care of. The business continuity plan will also obviously influence the disaster recovery plan that we put in place to bring up systems as we go further into the scenic project. We've done an executive level business impact assessment for 12 agencies. 72. We also, by the way, put in an enabling technology to help with this. We're putting in software that everybody will use, common software, to do this business continuity planning. And it has a couple of roles. One, it helps you with the planning, and it helps you sort through what can be pretty complex interrelationships. And two, it helps you in a crisis situation because you can go to it and it tells you what you need to restore. That actually is hosted in an off-site. For the simple reason that if you ever have a business disruption that's because your server goes down, it's hard to get to the software that tells you how to bring it back up. So we have that concept built into it as well. The enterprise BCP business case is done, and again, we've got a first draft of business continuity plan, and we continue to work on that. We need to expand this out and increase the number of agencies participating, train people in what the importance is and how you go about doing this. Get additional agency. We're going to have to bridge between the enterprise strategy and the agency-specific business continuity plan, and so we have to cement those things together and get increasing agency detail into the enterprise plan, and then pursue grant opportunities. And we're doing this both in the realm of business continuity planning and cybersecurity, and there is grant funding available from the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, and others to deal with these issues, particularly with the one-time transition or startup costs for these kinds of things. Finally, I'd just like to close by saying that we understand that the goal of information technology, it's not an end in itself. Information technology is a support function, and it's here to support the business of state government. So we want to make sure we're not the tail wagging the dog. And the value that we bring is that we understand what can be done, what can be accomplished through information technology, but it always must be driven by what the objectives of state government are, what the public policy and business objectives are. So the business needs drive technology and not vice versa. And that's one of the reasons that we're working through some of these governance bodies, because it's absolutely essential that our technology solutions and services support the business of state government. Enterprise programs are being approached in a collaborative, cross-agency manner for that reason, and also because it's the most effective way to get it done. I mean, there's a lot of work that has to be done to get everybody to collaborate, but if we're successful, as we're successful at doing that, we can produce services and initiatives that are sustainable and they really meet the business objectives of state agencies. Again, strategic planning will drive the future initiatives that we'll bring before the legislature, and the leadership from agencies provided in the technical realm by the CIO Council. That group plays a critical role in both identifying what the enterprise strategies are and supporting and prioritizing those, and also clearly understanding how what their agency-specific strategy is fits into the enterprise strategy. With these foundational pieces, I talked before about first you have to have a design and an architecture, and then you lay the foundation. That's what we're doing today. We've got the mechanism for the design and architecture. We've got the some foundational work done and put in place with the scenic project, and this will allow us to move much more quickly in response to evolving business needs and risks and issues that come along in the future. I know that in other conversations with legislative bodies that both Don and I have had, they've expressed understandable frustration with the fact that some of these issues and problems have been around in the state for many, many years. But we've made substantial progress in moving forward on these and dealing with these in a concrete way. So we're just talking about plans with you. We're actually delivering some things and positioning ourselves to be able to move a lot more quickly and effectively in the future.
Yes.
Couple questions, Mr. Chairman. Number one, on the CIO, or the Chief Information Officer Council, does that include local governments like counties, cities, school districts, and so on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roebelin, it's actually the Department of Education is represented on that group, and the Department of Education has a similar kind of a group that they work with the educational service districts, and we've done some interaction with them. We also have a county representative, one of the CIOs. The counties get together periodically. They have the Oregon Association of Information Technology folks in the county. They just changed their name, so I can't remember the acronym. But that group has a member that sits on the CIO Council as well, because there's a tremendous benefit to that. And one of the things that the counties tell us is that, gee, it'd be really nice if we had a standard way of interfacing with the state instead of having to interface with, you know, 15 different agencies in 15 different ways. So that's one of the reasons.
And second question.
Follow-up, certainly, Representative Roebelin.
Part of that architecture that you talk about, is that also include letting them know the size of, say, names and so on and so forth, when they're doing their architecture of the programs that they have that collect data, so that they can connect and send data back and forth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roebelin, that would be exactly the intent. Now, I understand that data is a little further out, so we're sort of at a more foundational layer now, but absolutely that would be the intent, yes.
Any other questions for...
Have a question?
Yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, okay. I'm wondering, you know, given the lack of general recognition amongst people of the importance of IT and the budget crunch that's going on, these initiatives run the risk of being a target of, you know, criticism by public as their wasteful government, like the Channel 2 news reports about, you know, there's $20 million building a new... Well, it could have gone to, you know, mental health medications or anything, which I yelled at the reporter about because it's something completely different about capital. And so I'm just wondering, what's your media strategy, and how do those of us who are involved in this help?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I think that one of the foundational problems is that we have not always done a good job. In fact, we've done not a bad job historically of articulating the value of IT, and that's not just within state government. I think information technology in general has not done a good job of explaining its value proposition. It's kind of, we know we need it, we can't explain to you why, and we don't have any metrics to show you. That's one of the reasons we took with the scenic project the business case approach, because if there's not a business case, if there's not a compelling financial reason and other reasons for doing it, then we shouldn't go forward with it. And that's the approach that we want to take with these. We don't, our strategy in terms of dealing with communication in general. We have a person who's responsible for communication. We use our website to communicate with. We try to make the governing board members and the steering committee members active advocates for the program. We don't have a media strategy per se, except to provide information and to be available to respond to inquiries. But I think to the degree we can be fact-based and clearly articulate the business value, then you have investment choices to make about which of these we move forward with.
Mike, when Representative Rose talks about the money, I mean, use the line, when they say show me the money, who will you show the money to? Will it be the department heads? Will it be the governor's office? Or will it be to the legislature? When we see the money, who will see the money?
Mr. Chair, I think it's the governor's project, so we would actually want to show the money to everybody to be able to demonstrate that it was captured. The savings we'll want to show the agencies, because they need to understand that they're getting their service levels met at the same or lower cost. The governor, obviously, we would show the money to, and that's the person who's really responsible or who supports this project and under whose auspices we're doing it. And we want to be able to demonstrate to the legislature that we've done what we said we were going to do, and the general public.
So when the place markers are in agency budgets, we'll see excess money out of those agencies that we'll be able to reallocate?
Mr. Chair, remember that for the next budget cycle, we're not projecting a return on investment. We're saying that this project, there's a one-time financing cost, and it's one of the reasons we've chosen COPs. There is no money or savings that will come out of the next budget cycle that will be available. What we're looking at is budgets following budget cycles.
2007, I think.
Correct. Yeah, that's where the current return on investment point is projected.
So in 2007, one of us survives the election process, you'll be able to show us the money.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? It is at this time in the agenda when we open the forum for public comment. We only have one public with no comment. Are there any other questions by the committee? Any other concerns? I would ask you to look over the schedule that we have, or the agenda that we have through February 17th. If we've missed something that you talked about at our last meeting, let me know, and I'll get with Dallas and we'll get it on there.
Actually, I guess, Mr. Chairman, forgive me for my absent-mindedness, but there was one other question I had for Mike, and that was that...
Certainly, Representative Burley.
If I may, thank you. Just out of curiosity, with the whole e-business concept and programs going on and all that, Oregon Centralized Voter Registration System doesn't seem to be on the list at all.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, the Oregon Centralized Voter Registration System is being implemented as in response to the Help America Vote Act, the HAVA Act, and we have worked with the Secretary of State on the planning of that system. So it's one of the major information technology initiatives that we keep an eye on that falls into that governance and oversight role.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
I believe we have that on the agenda too.
Just curious.
Are there any other questions? We have Mike here now, and thank you very much, Mike. Very informative. With that, we'll adjourn the meeting.